Welcome to You Are an IP Company podcast with Carrie Oberbrunner and Katie Rubino. Our passion is helping entrepreneurs publish, protect, and promote their intellectual property. This podcast is sponsored by Instant IP. And now, get ready for You Are an IP Company.
I just recently started my third company, and you might be surprised. You might say, what is that? You have Igniting Souls, you have Instant IP. Well, we're not going to tell you the name, but I will tell you that it's an IP holding company, and we'll tell you why we're not telling you the name. Katie, it's great to be with you today.
You too. Nice to see you.
Yeah. Well, listen, you know, in the book, You Are an IP Company, we have this chapter about IP holding companies. And, you know, back in 2024, when we were writing this, I just, you know, had you write that section and thought, you know, that's interesting. I might want to do that someday because it just made a ton of sense. And I might even find out where it says it in the book, because I think I might read that little section because it's so good.
It is good. I have a copy of it here.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Okay. So I can do this quick thing where I go Command F and like it get to the part, but I'll tell you what chapter it's in. And then Katie, first of all, while I find that, oh, here it is, page 145. It talks about Disney having an IP holding company. And then here it is here. So I'm gonna read this to you, okay? Establishing this type of company is quite common since it provides several benefits. An IP holding company can be a vehicle to exploit valuable IP while minimizing its exposure to operational liabilities. This separation allows you to protect your IP from both litigants and creditors in the event your operating company is sued. That was a quote that I cited in there, and people can find the end notes in the book. But then it says, the IP holding company does not engage in its own day-to-day business activities and serves only as a legal entity for safe housing intellectual property. And then we put in there several reasons why. Transparency. The holding company can help attract investors and secure additional funding by providing transparency around the business's revenue generating assets, tax efficiency, and monetization. So let's just start there, first of all, because you got this great section there. But why do you think people come to you, or why, you know, why did we create one, all this type of thing?
Yeah, no, good question. So I'd say forming an IP holding company, it's part of an overall business strategy. And it's a way to hold the IP assets in a separate entity. It's usually set up, I'd say, as an LLC, because that's very simple to manage from a tax purpose. It's pretty easy to implement. Mm-hmm. And then the IP holding company houses the IP. It's usually not an operational business, but then it licenses back the IP rights to the operating company or to maybe sub-entities of the operating company as needed. And this way, it's a clean separation for liability protection. And there's also ways in some states you can incorporate in a blind LLC where the beneficial owner isn't publicly listed on the state incorporation page. So it can kind of create an extra layer of just security. And I think at the end of the day, it's really about confidence for an entrepreneur to know that these assets that they're investing in are going to be kind of maintained and shielded as best as we can from different liabilities that might arise too.
I love that. And I know what people are thinking, because I thought the same thing. We always start with these self-limiting beliefs like, I'm not big enough for an IP holding company. I mean, that's something for Apple or Disney. But it's similar to what we say in the book, that you don't protect your IP when you're big. You become big by protecting your IP. I would say the same thing about IP holding companies. Like, why not start it now before you're massive? Because you start avoiding creating an IP holding company. And let's just talk about the dangers. So let's say all your IP, your trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, smart contracts, everything, patents, it's all in your operating business. Well, then what happens if it gets sued? Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you get this crazy lawsuit that you didn't even do anything wrong. And now a client or vendor or someone starts trying to take you to court. Now everything is up for grabs in a court. Is that, I mean, I know this is not a podcast where we give legal advice, but is that the general rule that
that's typically yes. And I'd say the other side of it too is, you know, protection if you're sued, but also protection if you're going to go sue somebody else, right? Because typically if we're going to go enforce patents against someone else, we might put them into a different entity to protect ourselves too when we're going to go enforce, because usually the first thing that happens when you enforce your patents is the other person tries to file something against you. So it's another way, another kind of shield and another layer of protection that you can build in.
That's
interesting. And it can work kind of offensively and defensively.
Wow. I never thought of it that way. So basically, if you feel like somebody's crouching in on your space and you sue them, then they will counter sue.
Mm-hmm. Counter sue, or sometimes they'll even a lot of times try to invalidate your patents, because if you're suing them, the first response is, well, I can't be an infringer because this patent isn't valid, right? So usually these sort of things get filed at the Patent and Trademark Office. They're called a post-grant review or an inter parties review. And they can be kind of a way to stall litigation, because once this is filed, the litigation in court is stopped and this kind of trial at the patent office is commenced to determine if the patent is really valid or not. Now, I'd say a lot of the time, some of the claims in the patent survive, some get killed off, okay. But other times it can be so drastic that the whole patent or even the whole patent family gets taken out. So that's where too, kind of the moat is important, to not have all of your hedging on one patent or one patent family, to kind of diversify your assets. Because if the more kind of asset diversification you have from an IP standpoint, the harder it's going to be for somebody to take out all of your IP.
Wow. It is a bigger game. I mean, I certainly, yeah. I would not have thought of this 3 years ago, 5 years ago.
Right.
But I will tell you that even in this last week, you know, when I visited you in Boston, we had two legitimate, serious infringers on two different items. And I felt very confident that we had done the due diligence, because essentially one person was trying to infringe on the entire company and business solution that we provide. And then the other one was basically infringing on a trademark. And the fact that we had something instant IP, you know, time stamped it, we could go back and say there it was, you know, gave me a lot of confidence. And I showed you before the pre-show, one infringer already took down, like within 24 hours, immediately they took down the infringement because they don't want to go into next level. So talk about that, maybe how the whole goal of this strategy is not to go to court.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people kind of have that wrong belief out there. Like, oh, you got to, you know, spend all this money to then sue people. But what talk about like how the the fence analogy. Somebody drives by your house and says guard dog, security cameras, and then they just keep driving.
Right. I'd say, you know, going to court and suing to enforce your IP, this is kind of a last resort option when we've kind of exhausted every other possible way to amicably resolve something. So a lot of times it's a simple outreach. And I, a lot of times too, I tell the client, go start the conversation first, because it's a little bit of a friendlier exchange than going in guns blazing with your lawyer doing an outreach, right? So I think a lot of times, depending on who you're going after, there can be a strategy here to employ to start it as a friendly conversation of, hey, heads up, you're infringing my IP, please take it down.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's enough, right? You had that happen this week, and that was enough to exhaust it. Now, if it won't get taken down, then we might need to get a lawyer involved. We might need to send a cease and desist letter. And sometimes we might even need to file suit, because that's enough of a threat. But I'd say even if we file suit and things commence, a lot of the time it settles out, because the cost and the time limitation of these kind of things can take years. It can cost millions of dollars. You have to get litigation funding. So it's a way, having your IP protected, it's kind of a shield, right? And you can kind of use that to your advantage to get people to respect your IP and to enforce your IP too. I think that's a part of the IP ownership, is that once you have it, you want to defend it too. It's like your property. It is your property, right? But think of it as a house. You know, if somebody's trespassing, you tell them to get off the property.
Right.
And so it's a way of kind of reaching out and starting that conversation about it.
Well, I think that's important, because again, a lot of people blow this stuff off because they don't take themselves seriously. Like, well, I don't have any IP. I don't have anything original. So maybe that's where it starts. And that's why our book is called You Are an IP Company. It's really an identity shift. But let's take that metaphor a little bit further and say, okay, let's say you do have land and someone's trespassing. It's one thing for somebody to walk across your property physically. It's another thing for them to build on your property.
Yeah. You
know? Like, well, you know what? I'm just going to build my own stuff on this property. And now they start building a building, just to continue the metaphor, they start building on your IP. And now what it does is it creates massive confusion for customers, because customers say, whoa, hold on. I thought this was I'm just going to give an analogy. I thought this was a McDonald's. That's what the map says. But now all of a sudden next to McDonald's, there's a dog training facility. You know, and what's going on here? Like, I'm not going to shop here anymore because I don't want a dog training facility right with McDonald's, you know? And so like, it does create that confusion. And even one of my trademarks is clarity attracts, confusion repels. So you can, if you don't take your property seriously, you could actually end up losing a lot of other customers, property, business, this type of thing.
Exactly. It is the fact that if you don't enforce your IP or put people on notice that you own IP, there can be this significant confusion and also this significant, you know, impersonation of your IP and ripping off of your IP.
Yeah.
And that's where too, you know, being intentional and strategically monitoring the landscape to figure out, you know, who else is out there, who else is in this space, and keeping a close eye on that. It's an important part of your overall business strategy.
Yeah, I love it. And then just to keep the metaphor going, people who don't take their IP seriously, we've told this story before, that some people are like, well, you know, I know people are stealing, that's fine. But then the concept is, okay, what if that person says to you, you know what? Get out of this house. I'm taking over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that does happen where people say, I'm not going to take my ideas and IP seriously. Somebody else does. They're more savvy. They go protect it and lock you out of your own intellectual property. That's pretty scary. So, I mean, I guess the modern day equivalents, I don't know a ton about this, but, you know, squatting or whatever it's called these days, where somebody can just move in and take over all your stuff. That's pretty scary.
That's really scary. And the thing is, too, there's also ways the IP holding company can be used for like long-term value creation.
Yeah.
And it can be used too in, as a way for, let's say you want to someday get acquired, right? And maybe you're going to sell your operating company, but you're not going to sell all of your IP that belongs to the operating company. Maybe some of the IP is going to be retained and not sold. So the IP company, holding company, can become a vehicle to house the IP that's not part of the transaction. And sometimes too, that can be used very intentional. If let's say there's some IP assets that don't relate to the operating company or that are just carve outs from the deal that maybe you're going to license to someone else, or maybe you're going to even license it to the operating company after it's sold. But it can be used as a very kind of tactile weapon, just for even long-term planning and growth phase of a company too.
I love that. I love that. My camera might've gone out, Katie, but you can still hear me.
We can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have you just keep talking and I'm going to switch my Wi-Fi, but tell us a little bit more about, you know, the tax implications.
Yes. So the other reason really a lot of entrepreneurs put a IP holding company into place is for tax and estate planning. And this is something, you know, you'd want to work with your financial and accounting team on. But there is this qualified small business stock tax credit. And what it is essentially is a exclusion of capital gains from federal income tax when you're selling different qualified small business stock. So the limit here, the cap on it used to be $10 million. But it's been increased to $15 million as of the 4th of July of this year. So it's a way to kind of earn tax credit against this that isn't taxable, and that it can kind of save money as part of a planning phase with an accountant. Now, the other kind of consideration, I'd say, when you are putting an IP holding company into place is then it's a couple of things. So I'd say the first thing you have to think about is moving the IP assets over from the operating company into the IP holding company. So usually the way that happens is through a deed of assignment. And what that does is it takes all of the IP, the different forms of IP, and each form of IP usually has its own assignment that's written up. And the assignment, think of this as an asset transfer that you would use for when you're assigning real property, like a house, ownership of a house. And so what that's going to do is then legally transfer the IP assets from the operating company into the holding company, so that the holding company then becomes the beneficial owner of the IP assets. And these assignments get written up, signed, and executed by the company that's the current owner, the assignor. And they also get signed by the assignee, meaning the company that's going to own the property now. And sometimes if you're an entrepreneur and you're the owner of the operating company and the IP holding company, you'll be signing those as both the assignor and the assignee. It's a little bit of a weird thing in theory, but in practicality, this happens quite a bit. And then that IP holding company is then going to license back the IP assets to the operating company. Now, sometimes there might be multiple operating companies. So figuring out which IP assets need to be used for those different operating companies to work and practice, that can be one part of the strategy, because maybe not all of the IP that's owned by the holding company has to get licensed back. And then once that's figured out, some kind of royalty, reasonable royalty, will be put into the license that the operating company will then pay back to the holding company for use of those IP assets. Usually it's a payment made each year. And I'd say, you know, you want to kind of work with your accountant and your IP counsel to figure out some way that that's going to get calculated. And usually I try to encourage entrepreneurs to kind of make it as simple as possible so that you're not doing these crazy calculations, you know. And I think a once a year payment, that's a kind of an easy way to implement and streamline it. So it's not some onerous task that has to be done each month. It can just be kind of done once a year, and kind of easy to scale up too.
That's awesome. Can you still hear me, Katie?
Yes. We have your picture back too.
Listen, you are given gold here. I think my Wi-Fi is just jacked today. So
full moon.
Keep talking.
Yes. So that's sort of the basics of it. And I'd say, you know, the other advantage of the IP holding company too is that the operating company doesn't have to be the exclusive licensing body of the IP. So what's great is that if, let's say, there's other companies or other businesses that want to license the IP or that are practicing the IP, that can all be continued to be licensed out from the licensing company. So the way that would get implemented would be as a non-exclusive license, so that the operating company isn't the sole licensing party, that the IP can then get licensed out to other parties as needed too. And I think that can play into your overall IP enforcement strategy as well, because a lot of times, you know, part of the outcome of the enforcement is to hopefully obtain a license from a potential infringer. So it's a way to kind of scale up operations for the IP monetization strategy too. And that can all be run through the IP holding company.
So good. Folks, that's why when I asked Katie if she'd consider co-writing the book, I knew she had a lot of wisdom. And of course, in the book itself, I think that was under the Disney chapter. And I just think it's super smart. So my biggest statement to you all would be, don't think you have to be super, super big to get this. I mean, the moment you have any IP, whether it's a logo, whether it's a proven process, a unique system, a trademark, whatever. Those are the days that you want to consider this. And I love what you shared about that incredible opportunity called the Qualified Small Business Stock. People call it the QSBS, where there's a lot of wisdom there. Folks, look into that. But yeah, if you're going to sell your company and at least wait a few years, perhaps 5 years, the statement, at least currently on the books, is that the first $15 million upon an exit could be tax-free. Mm-hmm. And again, this podcast is not tax advice, but my person, Wheelwright, Tom Wheelwright, they are fantastic. Karen and Myra are my people over there. And you know, we set all this up on purpose. So these are the things that little changes now that might cost you a little bit money now could save you literally millions and millions of dollars in the future. So Katie, this was fantastic. I know that I want people to save a date. I think we mentioned it last time, but we're going to really try to get this book signing on November. November 9th, right in the evening. We'll announce a location, but if you're listening to this in 2025, love to have you come. And thanks so much, Katie, for all the value you gave today.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Take care, everybody. We'll see you.
Thank you for listening to You Are an IP Company Podcast with Carrie Oberbrunner and Katie Rubino. Visit instantip.today for more help on your IP journey. Remember, your ideas are valuable. Protect them today.